Colleen Dewhurst is a lavishly talented actress whose work in the theater over the past 27 years has frequently drawn high praise from critics and on at least four occasions distinguished awards. But in all those years, she's never known the satisfactions of playing in a Broadway hit. Not until this year, when she opened on Broadway in O'Neill's Moon for the Misbegotten to rave reviews, long lines at the box office, and a run that has no end in sight. The long-delayed recognition follows upon years of principal roles in such plays as Desire Under the Elms, The Ballad of Sad Cafe, Camille, and Morning Becomes Electra, as well as many roles in motion pictures and in television drama. Dewhurst, much is being made of the fact that this is the first Broadway hit you've played in, and I suppose that it's changed your life somewhat. Fame has come your way. Is this what you've been working for 27 years?
No, I don't think it's what I've been working for. Although I began to feel strange when everybody would say to me, how come, you know, it's taken you all this time, and isn't this wonderful, it's finally happened. And finally I said, well, my problem has been that for maybe 5 or 6 years, I thought everything was terrific. And now everybody's just told me that obviously it wasn't. Mm.
I think that I had no idea at all of what a commercial success meant when I would say I wanted a commercial success. It became...
But you did want one.
Oh, yes. It became a kind of joke that... I was the kiss of death. If you put me in the play, you could be guaranteed if you got 3 months, you had a long run. And I think that there is a very definite difference in having a commercial success from having what I suppose you would call an artistic success, which finally got to be a pretty boring term for me, in which people would say, well, it's too bad that nobody wants to come, Colleen, but artistically it's wonderful. Because if you're not succeeding in front of a group, an overall group, then you really don't have a success.
What is success in the theater other than being employed, which is, I suppose, the basic success, isn't it?
Well, I think probably what makes this a success, whatever that word means, and the reason that it's caught everybody's imagination within the theater is that the shock of being in a real theater piece, in a Eugene O'Neill, in a play that has a theme that if you were to describe it to a public, to ask them to come, you know you wouldn't reach 2% of them. So that I think the shock value of never suspecting that it would be, you can play another place and you say, well, all right, now according to everything I've heard, this should go. It has humor, it has sex, it has this, it has that, and you come in and it's nowhere. Now you come in with a play where you say, well, obviously we have about 5 weeks. That should use up the Eugene O'Neill coterie, the actor's coterie, and then we'll be through and we'll proceed on out to the road.
That didn't happen, of course.
No.
And it, as you say, if you describe the play to a theater goer, he might say, no, that's not for me. And yet, it's been a great success.
People will tell me that they'll say, well, you know, I hate O'Neill.
Yeah. What's made the difference?
I was hoping you were going to tell me.
Of course.
Began to sit different places, listening to the introductions to us, to try and understand what it was that was happening. I remember Ed Flanders saying to me one night, it would have been a very responsive audience, and he came up and said to me, wouldn't you give anything to sit out front one night and to find out what happened? I think maybe this is the way the great things in your life do happen, which makes them the surprise. Maybe because I've thought about a lot of it, maybe because all the motives were, shall we say, pure by mistake. Mm-hmm. It isn't the case of actors standing around saying, I wanted to do something wonderful only because I wanted to do it and I didn't care that it would only play here or there. But I think that when we started for the right reasons. We wanted to be together, we wanted to do something that we loved. And when anybody wanted us, we were all stunned, whether it was Chicago, Washington, whichever place wanted us. It seemed wonderful to us that they did.
You haven't had a particularly easy time in the theater in those 27 years. Some of the times have been pretty tough. Why didn't you ever give it up? What kept you going?
It never entered my mind.
It didn't?
No. Never entered my mind to give it up. I don't think you can give anything, as I've said so many years. I've heard people say, I'll give it 5 years, I'll give it 10 years. I think then you should step out right then. It just, from the very beginning, I just knew that that was what I wanted to do. And I never thought of, I didn't think it was hard times.
You didn't?
No. Mm. The early years, yes, I knew were hard times, but there were many people beside you who were having the same thing. Mm-hmm. So the cold water flats, the not eating, the not being able to get work. I find now that I think that one of the greatest enemies of the artist is bitterness. I would see a kind of bitterness creeping into the faces and the attitudes of actors that I'd known as years would go by, 4 years, 5 years, 6 years.
Why bitterness? Where'd that come from?
Usually, I think because when you are not succeeding and when you are reaching different ages and standards in the United States that require that you have make a decision about yourself and about your life, you're hitting New York between the ages of 18 and 22. All those homes that they have left, they either have married, they have begun families, they are into law offices, into medical offices, into PR, into something. Suddenly, you are like, I suppose in our age, it would have been like what would look like the eternal hippie. You're still in the cold water. You're still eating the tuna fish. You're still behaving in what seems to be an irresponsible manner. You're taking any job that you can get for 4 months and dropping it at once if anybody offers you anything in the theater. And finally, I suppose what happens is an attack of what we would call the system. It is easier to blame out there, to say, well, you can't get anything because unless you know someone.
Yeah, externalize it.
That's right, which I'm sure you all do at certain times. But I found later that when I look at people, and even today, that this seemed to be one of the great defeatists. It is something that affects them physically and morally, and then begins to affect the work. Then you have an inability, I think, to give, because maybe you made a mistake originally about what much you were there for.
And giving is important in successful acting?
Yes, I would say that I suppose you're giving back to life what you have taken from it up to that point. That you don't have to learn to do it because every day that you live, there should be something more added to you that the next time around. I remember I used to be frightened when I was out of work for a period of time. I'd think, oh dear. And every time you go in to read a play, when we went in to read Moon, even though I'd done it, we were all nervous with each other, even though we knew each other. The insecurity of the actor, the fear that something won't happen that's happened before. And with Jose and I in particular at that point, we hadn't worked for a while. And then you find maybe after the second or third day, you realize that there was no need to worry on a certain level because the living that you had done up to Lent had enriched you again for this particular experience.
I should think it would require a tremendous amount of faith in yourself over these times when, as you say, the people around you were successful, you seem not to be successful. What was the source of the kind of faith that you must have had over some of these tougher times? Faith in yourself.
I don't really know. I find now, when you were asking about success, I find now that people will speak to me as though there was some grand design, which is very complimentary, that I had planned to play the roles I had and that I had decided to have the life I'd had. I don't believe that's true. I believe I somehow washed with the waves. I went where I was asked to go. If I wanted to go, I went. I think just to work was important to me. I think I also played just as hard. Maybe I was not as, I appeared maybe not to be as driving as other people, but I believe that in my own way I was just as driving. Maybe not even quietly, maybe just different.
Yeah.
It's just that it wasn't a question of faith, it was just, I think that I just never doubted that that would be what would be my life.
You say that you wanted to be an actress almost from the beginning. You were born in...
Not from the beginning. Nothing. No, I didn't. I wasn't interested
in
acting.
Child.
No.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Not at all.
You were something of a tomboy
when
you were quite young in Montreal, and later, I guess, in a number of cities in the Middle West and the East.
Yes, I had a dad who... I was an only child, and my father was a great athlete.
He was a hockey player, wasn't he?
He was. He said to me about 2 months ago, he said, "Will you stop talking about hockey? That wasn't my great game." He said, "I keep being called about hockey." Yeah. "No, Colleen, not hockey." He was the first man to bring amateur hockey to the States. And he said, "That's why I managed teams, because I didn't play too well." He was a great baseball player and a great football player. When I was very young, I used to say that he made me a great wife and mistress because I knew all the rules. He'd sit with me, I think I would be 8 or 9, and we'd sit at the ball games in Boston, and he'd say to me, "What's he going to do?" And I'd say, "Bunt." He'd say, "Perfect." And we'd go to the football, and I can remember we used to go to see the, in Boston, we'd go to see the Bruins play, and Eddie Shore would skate up and say hello, and I'd be terribly excited. I remember my dad had a bat that was it must have been an oak. It was a deep brown with his name in gold on the side. We lived out here in Crestwood. I was about 13. The kids had come over, and I'd go up on the wall of his den and take that bat. I knew he came home at 5:45. And I had a pillow, and I'd put the pillow down, I'd hit the ball, I'd lay the bat on the pillow and run. But sometimes he'd come home and I'd forgotten, right? He'd pick up the bat, don't ever touch that bat again. So then I was, and I was glad later in a way that was the way I did grow up.
You went to, I understand, went to some 15 separate schools, which meant a constant adjustment for you.
Oh, it was dreadful. I got so that I... the mention of the first day of school was enough to make me be ill at once. I would just get sick at my stomach.
In looking back, was that a liability or an asset, not getting sick, but going to 50 schools?
Well, I realize now, because I had made a vow that if I had children, that they would stay in the same school forever. But I find now that we can't ever judge what's good or bad for any of us, can we? Because, strangely enough, I was terribly shy and ill at ease as a child, and it was agony. And maybe that agony was the fact that I had to go and I had to adjust to the fact that, as we know, as you get older and get into high school, it's even, I went to 3 different high schools, it's even worse because then we're into that clique thing, especially with young girls, you know, where you're either with, you're with your clique and then you're suddenly pulled out of that and moved into another school. And
you're, so you're always an outsider.
That's right. And then you have to move in again and you're constantly going through that kind of play. And it was, although I love school. But then I noticed with the boys, I had to take them to Spain, and I put them in the American school over there, and it was very disturbing for them. And I didn't like it that they found it so disturbing, because I began to think that maybe it was not so good that they be constantly at ease. There are people in this world that will not like us.
It's easier if you're the victim, I think, than if you're the parent. Certainly it's tough for a parent to allow his own child to go through what he's gone through, even what he feels it may have been good for him.
Yes. Of course, we must give them something to fight against, too, don't we? I mean, I think that now sometimes we don't give them a strong enough fight. I can remember when I was young, I was very happy at home, but I loved to be depressed about it.
Oh.
I mean, everybody loved it. I mean, you'd sit around, the one who came from the unhappiest home had the biggest audience. You know, they'd sit there and it'd all be so dramatic and everything. Nothing was happening in my home. It all seemed to be going perfectly well, but I'd try to think up things that might be wrong, you know.
You've been quoted as saying that your mother brought you up as a person. What do you mean by that?
Well, she was... She was a very independent woman, very beautiful, very relaxed about herself, I realize now, very relaxed about herself as a woman in a society then which wasn't. She just never brought me up to... Marriage was not important. This was not a goal.
Mm-hmm.
She liked men, sincerely liked them, and she sincerely liked women. So that there was nothing in my home in terms of war of the sexes, or if you're going to get up there, then you must remember that this must be done, and we must destroy him if he dares to step out of line, or this or that. The important thing to her was I guess what we'd call the mental and the spiritual. And that she felt that it was only through continuing to learn of ourselves in some kind of self-knowledge that we would be able to form any partnerships, whether they be marriage or friendships or anything, that if we had nothing to give, if we stopped at some point in that search, we would be finished. There was never any talk of age in the house. She, and sincerely so, I realize now too, she had no thought about it. And so she always remained quite extraordinary. I don't remember her changing now that I think of watching her through those 30 years. I don't remember her really changing because she always seemed to be the same woman. And, I think she gave me pride in being a woman. And
what does that mean?
I think that it's a potential that she used to speak of, that women considered themselves the tender, the understanding. She thought that men had the soaring thought.
The soaring thought?
Yes, the ability to soar. And that women had chained themselves to this. That they, but that was only when we talk about women's lib, I think, of what she used to say, because it's true that it's important what's happening to women. But they must deal with what's happening in the home with those children, with those young girls, that it isn't about do they get the insurance. Do they get the alimony? Do they get the house? And yet you can't blame them, because that's the way that they have been raised to think, is that if they are left, this will be all that's left. So it doesn't give them time to deal.
You've said that you never really wanted to be married, and yet you've been married three times, twice to the same man, and both of your husbands have been actors.
Yes, and I always said I'd never marry an actor. Well, enough of that, right?
Yes.
That was one thing my mother used to say. I used to come home sometimes and I'd say, I'll tell you one thing I'll never do. She'd say, don't say it, dear, because whenever you say it, the next day you do it. It's just obligatory with me to do it. I think I was the first girl in my class down the aisle. I think probably, too, that we're in a society that as soon as you say you don't want to get married, any gentleman who's dating you asks you to marry him. If he hasn't had it anywhere near his mind,
that's the challenge.
It poses an ego problem suddenly. What does she mean she doesn't want to get married, man? I was fortunate. I loved both men that I was married to. I thought the relationships had much in them that I remember with a great deal of joy.
Was it supportive in terms of your career? Was it wise from a professional point of view to be married to an actor?
No. But except that I do think that one of the problems that happens why actors marry actors is that, like any profession, it's easier to come home and talk to each other about what the problems are. You both understand fully what you're talking about. In order to give a background to someone else would take years.
Yes.
You know, you'd have to have someone who was marvelously intuitive to be able to deal with you. I've heard men so often, you know, they'll say to me, well, Colleen, one thing I won't do is marry an actress. I may date them. But finally they will, because they find out when they date other women and they begin to say, I'm having this problem on stage, or I can't this, or I...
There's no understanding.
There's no response.
You have two children now, teenage children, living on a farm and driving home every night for an hour and a half after the performance here in Manhattan. Why do you commute so far, given the intensity of the work that you're doing right now?
Well, it has been more difficult with this play, I will admit, because of the length of time that it has been a success. But I find that, well, that's another mistake. I mean, I ended up on that farm by mistake. I mean, I didn't, my second and third husband there, it was his idea to go up to this wonderful farm. And I remembered I kept saying, well, you mean like people do, we have an apartment in New York? And he said, no, we just live on that farm. And that's when I learned to drive, when I realized that I was trapped on this farm an hour and a half from New York. I thought, well, I better drive, because nobody's obviously going to take me back and forth. But then I found that, I think after a year, I grew to love it. And it's wonderful for the children. It's a natural background for them. And I like the children that they meet there. Mm-hmm. And I like the lack of being impressed. The community I find very interesting as a community, because it's not suburban.
What happens when you come off the stage after an exhausting performance and have to get into a car and drive that distance?
Well, I enjoy that drive. I find that while I'm driving, I'm thinking about a great many things, either what's happened that night on stage or what's happening at the house. I think also because I remember I used to like taxi rides too, and I tried to analyze why. It's because you're in limbo. At that point, from that garage to the driveway, there is no way in the world for anybody to get to you. Not either from the life you're returning to or for the life that you've just left. There is an hour and a half there in which you are completely on your own, and you could, I've thought about it, you could drive 1,000 miles and pass it all and never come back, but at least it gives you that, and there's something about driving at night when it's quiet, and that strange camaraderie of just seeing other lights once in a while coming up.
Is acting fulfilling for you?
Yes, very.
Why?
Well, I think because probably inside of us all there are many different men and many different ladies. And in your daily life, we present different masks to different people. And on stage, whatever character you're playing, you can isolate that particular lady and let her come out while you cut away the other ones that would
interrupt
her.
Does that mean the role is in some facet of you, as a rule?
Yes, I would say that it is a facet. Well, you're trying to find some part of you that would understand that particular lady. I would imagine that's why you take different roles and don't take others. You may have no understanding at all of a certain woman, even though she might be fascinating. I was never good in Shaw, and I never understood it. I thought I would be a wonderful Shaw woman, and I tried again and again, but I never was good. And depressed me no end that I couldn't play them. And I finally realized that maybe it was that I needed, that Shaw was very intellectual. And that I somehow needed a kind of an emotional kickoff to the lady, a kind of intuitive kickoff rather than a rational one. Mm-hmm. Rational if you got into trouble. You know, if there's a scene that you can't find it, and the whole rest of the play falls in, but this one scene will not come, then you must rationally sit and figure out what it is you want as the character.
But the preparation requires some introspection into yourself, then.
Well, I can't deal with that too much because, first of all, I find it boring, actors talking about actors, especially if there's a self-indulgence form. I would say, though, probably, there's a great deal of study at home, and then you just release your mind and yourself, and you enter that stage. And then coming from you to me, something begins to happen as it would if we were sitting here. And then it's natural.
Is playing the role you're playing now, and many of the roles you've played in the past, as intense as it is, emotionally exhausting? Or are you simply able to project, with the skill you do, a role that doesn't take anything from you?
No, I think the lady does take something from me each night, but she also gives me something back. So that when I come out, I feel... In other words, that you're doing out there may be the real you. I don't mean the part, but the actress may be the real you, and the one that they see at the curtain call is the mask. I don't know.
Thank you very much. ¶¶